Hello, everybody, and welcome to Reason Town, episode 16. I have an interview recorded with Sean Grove to give to you today. Sean Grove from One Graph, the company. I think you'll enjoy it. Unfortunately, we experimented with a new recording tool, and we didn't do a good job, so the recording doesn't sound that great. The content is still good, though, I hope. So enjoy, and I want to remind you that hosting for this episode is sponsored by TylerMcGinnis.com, which is the linear, course-based approach to learning web technologies. Tyler McGinnis is a good person. He does good teaching. Like, I know him personally. I like him, and I like his teaching style, and I've worked with him before, and I think you'll like it too, so please check it out. Also sponsored by my company, Day One, which gives me time to work on this podcast. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Day One. I love the company. I love the product as well. Here we go with the interview with Sean. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Reason Town. Today, my name's Murphy Randall. I always forget to introduce myself. I'm a developer living in Utah, and I work for a company called Day One, where I use Reason to make a sync server and applications related to the Day One journaling app on iOS. And I'm here with Sean Grove, who is the co-founder or founder of One Graph. We're going to find out soon. Sean, thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. First, yeah, definitely a co-founder. I have, and kind of the lesser of the two co-founders, I would say, technically. I've been working in Clojure and Reason and Rust for quite a while. My co-founder was also a Clojure person before. And so this is, for both of us, the first company where we work in Reason ML for kind of full time. But it's been a really interesting journey so far.
Awesome. So is this first time founding as well? Like this is your first gig business-wise?
No. So actually I went through an accelerator called Y Combinator back in the summer of 2011. And then we also just recently went through it in summer of 2018 with One Graph. So 2011 was my first company I founded. And then this is the second.
Awesome. And for those who don't know, Y Combinator is kind of like the father of accelerators in a sense. I guess the mother of accelerators. It's a big deal. What was your first company? Did that end up succeeding? Did you let it go?
Yeah. So the company was a company called Bushido, and it was kind of around summer 2011. So it was Heroku had just been acquired by Salesforce, and there were a lot of people who were trying to be Heroku for PHP or ASP or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, you know, if the market was heading in this like ubiquitous platform as a service direction, then we could just kind of take that for granted. What could you build on top of that? And so what we tried to do was build a app store for open source apps so that you could go to any GitHub repository, click a button, it would launch that app, it would be running, you know, full fidelity, it would automatically synchronize data between all of the apps hosted on the platform. So if you launched a CRM and a bug tracker and, you know, a design tool, they would all work together kind of seamlessly, even though they didn't know about each other.
Wow, so that sounds incredibly complex.
Yeah, it was definitely several companies worth of problems to kind of attack. And then the idea was then we would take the share of the revenue from hosting it and then give that back to the open source developers. The goal was to kind of make open source more sustainable for people to work on full time.
Wow, interesting. I was actually just talking about with developers today online. Seems like a lot of people have tried and nobody's really gotten it yet.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are actually quite a few challenges. So we didn't succeed for a number of reasons, mainly, I think, inexperience around business, but also, I think, tech-wise. So in 2011, you know, I was compiling, you know, custom Linux kernels to run on EC2 with to enable containerization. This is all like pre-Docker and all that kind of thing.
Wow.
And now it's like
clairvoyant.
Well, now it would work a lot better, right? Like I think you can do this thing a lot more easily. You can work on the more interesting problems rather than all that low level plumbing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So do you think that I guess this is kind of a useless question, though I am going to ask it anyway. I mean, if you went back and did Bushido again today with the tools you have today and the business knowledge you have today, do you think it'd have a better chance of succeeding?
I think the there's actually like a fundamental problem with most open source projects, probably. One is like just getting one app to the quality where you can actually attract customers and support them properly and scale that out is really challenging. Mm-hmm. And the second is that most open source, if you install an app, there isn't like a table for organizations oftentimes, right? You're just building for, you know, as an internal tool for your company.
Yes.
And so that means it does not scale very well at all, right? If RAM is the limiting cost factor for most, you know, cloud providers, then like it just gets really expensive to boot up all these different instances. And then you have also security concerns and whatnot. So like trying to think about how I do approach this every now and then, I'm curious how to make open source, you know, better quality, more polished and more sustainable. But it is, like you said, it's a really hard nut to crack.
Yeah, definitely. I was daydreaming that maybe there would be some kind of solution where companies would not only pay for open source with sponsorship like they do currently, but what if companies could actually make money by letting their employees or encouraging their employees to work on open source libraries as part of their dev time? You know, like if there was some way to be accountable and there's some like money pot, you know, so that open source libraries aren't all just the domain of people in their spare time, but rather companies could both sponsor projects that they're using to have other developers work on them and also receive money for letting their developers work on projects. I don't know if anyone would sign on, but it's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, I think at least for, you know, if you think about like you're trying to recruit really good talent and, you know, oftentimes, especially, for example, in the Reason world, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure that isn't easily accessible or, you know, isn't as polished as it could be. And so you kind of have to rush to make it usable as quickly as possible. But you always want to go back and kind of polish it and grow it out. And I suspect that there would be a lot of developers who would be attracted if, you know, they could take their 20% time and work on one of those projects that the company's using and like really polish it out, build out tests or documentation or that kind of thing.
Could be a beautiful world. Right. There's a lot of potential there. So that's cool. So that was Bushido. And then I'm guessing that is over, that didn't succeed.
Yeah. So we closed that down around late 2014, early 2015. And then I went on to run engineering for a payments company called PayGarden. And that was a closure shop and kind of built out a lot of the different systems there. It was a super high leverage team, just an amazing team to work with, both from an engineering point of view. Again, it was a bunch of, you know, ex-Googlers, XYZ people. So everyone had this very strong startup mentality, very good engineering ability. And again, I was just kind of the weakest person from a technical and business point of view. So it was a great experience to be able to grow and actually ship a product. So I did that for about 2.5 years. And during that, actually around the time we were closing down Bushido, I was working, you know, there's this new thing called GraphQL. And I was working on, you know, looking at that, and I kind of built this, I realized that you could kind of like join together all these different internet sources. I was hitting a lot of different APIs at the time. And I was thinking, you know, oftentimes I have to jump from one API to another. And I like this GraphQL thing had seemed like it could be an interesting route to go down to solve some of those problems. But it was definitely way too early, you know, for the market to do that. That was definitely one of my learnings from Bushido is being too early to market is the same as being wrong in a business sense. So I thought I would try to be patient here. But this one kept coming back and biting me, in particular dealing with a Salesforce integration. I've done 4 Salesforce integrations before, and each one is pretty painful. And PayGarden, they were like, "Oh, Sean, you've done Salesforce integrations. Why don't you build ours out?" And I was like, "Man, friends don't ask friends to do Salesforce integrations. That's not cool." But I mean, really, it should have been probably a 30-minute project of just kind of I knew which data I wanted to get out of Salesforce, and about 20 minutes of that should have been trying to figure out how to graph the data or whatever. And so I really wanted this this really easy way to get data out of these different services. And so this kind of sprung up as a nights and weekend project that I decided to do in OCaml and went full-time with that back in May. So probably worked on it for about a year while I was at PayGarden, kind of nights and weekends. And so now doing it full-time.
May of what year?
May of this of 2018.
Oh, May of this last year. Yeah. Wow. That was recent. So then that's very interesting. So what tickled your fancy about OCaml at that point?
Well, so I had been working in Clojure for quite a while, and there are a lot of things to enjoy and to love about Clojure and Clojure Script especially. And I really kind of explored. I felt like there must be a better way to build apps, and that's what led me to Clojure in the first place. But as Clojure kind of scaled out for us, even with really good engineers, I would find myself in very painful situations where, you know, I would go into a code base and I would look at, you know, some bug or some feature I was trying to add, and I would try to think about, all right, what do I need to change to implement this or to fix this bug? And it was very easy to reason locally and miss that someone else was relying on this bit of code or this data structure or this key name or something like that and cause damage far away. And so this kind of led to a state of paranoia where I was just afraid to touch bits of code. And there are lots of ways to fix this, obviously, but a lot of them require kind of social change. And social change is, I think, very difficult. It's hard to get people to change their behaviors. And so what I wanted was a system that I could be, call it weak, I guess, and it would kind of shore up my weaknesses so that it would allow me to reason locally. And so I did a lot of exploration in typed languages. And I think the combination of that and probably unikernels. So we shipped a unikernel project at the company, and it was that was in OCaml. And so I think it was a combination of wanting types and wanting to have control over low-level system details that kind of brought me into OCaml in the first place.
Can you quickly explain what a unikernel is?
Yeah, so it's unikernels are super fun ideas. I think they're OCaml actually leads the way mostly right now. The idea right now is you build these apps. You know, we're very careful about building up apps and like reducing as much code as possible and making sure that the security vulnerabilities are as minimal as possible. And then we kind of take that pristine app that we've built and we put it on top of the Linux kernel, which is, you know, 15 million lines of memory and type unsafe code, like potentially. And okay. The idea is, even if you're not using some of that Linux kernel, it's still there. And there are still security vulnerabilities that you're potentially exposed to. My favorite example here was with AWS. Someone found out that because of the Xen hypervisor was exposing a virtual floppy disk driver for EC2, they were actually able to find a vulnerability and escalate out of the hypervisor and see data across, you know, all of the different instances, which is like game over for AWS.
And so, holy cow.
Yeah, that's from like a virtual floppy disk driver. Like, how many people are using floppy disks in the cloud, right?
It's astounding.
Yeah, but the fact that it was there means that everyone was affected. So the unikernel people, it's basically this idea, especially with OCaml, is what if we were to re-implement all of those nice things we get from the kernel, like a TCP stack, process isolation, all this kind of thing. And so whenever we compile down, we'll actually compile into our own OS that runs directly on the hypervisor.
Wow.
And so instead of 15 million lines of, you know, this memory unsafe and type unsafe code, we'll have, you know, maybe, you know, 10 to 20,000 lines of type and memory safe OCaml. And normally that would be insane because you'd have to rewrite, you know, OpenSSL and all of these crazy libraries that we just take for granted.
Yeah.
But luckily, the OCaml Labs people out at Cambridge have basically just been doing this for 10 years now. And it's to the point where you can build, you can develop almost a normal OCaml application just on your desktop, like you're developing any native OCaml application. And then you flip a few switches and it will produce a either Xen or KVM binary that just boots up directly on the hypervisor, has nothing. If you don't use any library, if you don't use a network stack, that won't include the OCaml compiler works. So it's just this really cool way of building applications. It got me really excited and I wanted to play with it.
That's astounding. And so you just select the architecture for your EC2 instance and then it basically say, just deploy this. I don't even know how that works. I'm not that low level. So it's like you'd get a KMI somehow and say, yeah, stick it on this box.
So it's more like you create. So EC2 isn't super well suited to it. Google Cloud is actually much, much nicer.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I forgot you were running on Google Cloud.
Yeah. The issue with AWS is you have to create a bootable image, you know, like an AMI.
Yeah.
But you have to do that on EC2. So you can't compile it locally. So you have to set up all of this infrastructure just to be able to do continuous deployment.
Okay.
Whereas with Google Cloud, basically you just say rather than using the Debian bootable image, I'm going to just give you a tar file that instead of being 10 gigabytes is 10 megabytes. And it boots in under 20, 30, 40 milliseconds.
That's astounding.
Yeah. And the coolest thing is you end up it totally changes how you can architect applications, right? So serverless in serverless JavaScript and the really good scenario is going to end up using, booting up in a hot code path, maybe in 40 milliseconds, something like that, in order to run a single function.
Sure. Yeah.
And the unikernel can actually boot the entire server in less than that, right? In maybe 5 to 10 milliseconds with some of the new stuff they've been doing.
That's astounding. With fewer security holes.
Yeah, exactly. And then there ended up being this project called Jitsu, which is just-in-time summoning of unikernels. And what you would do is they realized that the time to boot a unikernel is less time than the reply window for a TCP connection. So they would have a load balancer sitting there with no servers running. A TCP connection would come in. They would literally boot up an entire new server just for this one connection and run everything. And then as soon as that connection went away, they would throw the server away.
You're kidding me. That's incredible.
Right? It's so cool. It got me really excited kind of realizing we can rethink how we do applications. You don't have to split everything up into functions. It felt like you could get a lot of the convenience, a lot of the security, and so much more performance all at the same time, along with all the safety that OCaml offers you.
That's astounding. So I remember we talked about this a little bit in chat beforehand, and I don't think you had gotten to the point where you were actually shipping unikernels for OneGraph.
No, so we probably won't ship unikernels for, I don't know if we will ever get there. So unikernels have to have no dependencies. First, they should have very few dependencies on C. Any C dependencies, you have to learn, figure out how to cross-compile. So that's a big thing right there. We originally built OneGraph. So OneGraph is all Reason Native on the back end. And so we originally built that using LWT and CoHTTP for the web server.
Okay, let's pause for a second and back up because this is awesome. And I totally forgot that we haven't even said what OneGraph is yet. That's the company that you made that does give us the one line explanation about what OneGraph does.
Yeah, sure. So it's a single API endpoint that you can query into and get data from Stripe, Salesforce, Gmail, Spotify, whatever.
So is it more than schema stitching as a service?
It's very similar to schema stitching as a service. We also so we have APIs that are not GraphQL. So most APIs are not GraphQL. And we provide a GraphQL interface into them and also between them.
That's huge. Yeah, that's huge.
And then we also handle authentication and normalize that across all the different services.
Wow.
So we have, for example, we canonicalize the error. So let's say that you're writing an app that needs to deal with both Stripe and Salesforce and Zendesk, right? Maybe you're writing an internal dashboard and you need your users to sign into these different things. You can actually have just one switch statement, which says, whenever an error comes back, you try to query into one of these services. We'll give you as much data as we can. You can check the errors field, and you can say, what is the type of error? And if it's a auth/auth missing, you can simply pluck out the service field and prompt the user to log into this. So it really reduces errors that you can have really, really reactive UIs that handle error cases, which developers usually hate doing, with very little code. And it makes for a really nice app as well.
That is awesome. Okay, now I'm catching the vision way more than I did before. And I assume that you're constantly adding new integrations.
Yeah, so actually one that we will be probably pushing pretty hard soon is Spotify. So basically over December, this was a little side project I was working on that I wanted to have a fun API. And so we went out and we brought in Spotify. So Spotify actually has a pretty good set of documentation for the API. And I also rewrote, we have some closure code that parses OpenAPI specs, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's a way of describing your API in JSON so that you can get a bunch of like nice tools. Here are all of our different endpoints. Here are the parameters they take. Here's the data returns, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And so we had some closure code that would read that and generate some reason code that we would use to actually interact with these services, because both Reason and GraphQL have to know what are the types that are coming back from this API. So I rewrote that in Reason for a couple of different reasons, and then generated a Spotify client, built that out, and like it's just really, really cool to play with Spotify and like from an API point of view, just kind of clicking around and seeing the API just work immediately. It's like a really exciting feeling.
Man, that's super cool. As you've been talking, I've been thinking about the kind of stuff that we could do with this and just realizing, like, I work for a journaling company. We could do some cool stuff where if users add Spotify links to their apps, you know, we could even add like a feature that that is opt-in, of course, because this could be horrible if it were automatic. But like, let's say you're reading your journal entries. As you're scrolling through, it could start playing the Spotify songs that are linked into the journal entries automatically in the background.
Yeah, no, that would be super trivial to this. It would take you, I don't know, probably 15, 20 minutes from start to finish.
Very cool.
And like, that would be a really fun, fun thing.
Wow. Okay, I'm starting to get excited, so I better not distract anymore from the technical conversation by business ideas. But okay, I caught the vision of OneGraph. I love it. I'm sold. So tell us about the back end now. You said that, okay, pause. This is a big deal. It's all Reason native. So this is like the cutting edge of cutting edge, because you're using a language that almost nobody uses, which is Reason, which is all of us, which is like, you know, the 200 people that are listening to this. No, I'm kidding. There are more than that. But there are actually quite a few more than that to listen. But point is, very small niche language. And then you go do server side, which is like, I'm one of the very few people that I know that's trying to do that. And then you do it native server side. And I don't know of anyone who's trying to do Reason native server side seriously, except for you. So are you the only ones that you know of that are trying to do this seriously?
Well, I think Jane Street's is probably another very prominent one that all of their internal stuff is OCaml native.
Which, but that's, you know, that's not Reason, right? That's OCaml. So I guess it doesn't matter, because Reason's just a syntax around OCaml.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned LWT, right? As explain the two frameworks you mentioned, LWT and HTTP. What was it?
Yeah, sure. So on the native side, so a lot of things, you know, that people ask whenever they're first coming into OCaml or Reason on the native side, they ask, what's the concurrency story, right? Does it do multi-core yet?
That this was my like first question.
Exactly. Everyone has been asking that for like 10 years now. And the idea is, you know, OCaml currently, you know, multi-core is coming somewhere down the road, but right now it's only single core. But it has concurrency that's very similar to Node, which is it's a single process, but you can, you know, use it with non-blocking I/O and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And one of the, I don't know, the characteristics of OCaml and its community is that there are always two of everything. So there are two concurrency libraries that implement Node-style concurrency. And the lighter weight one is called LWT, which I think is maybe lightweight threading is the name.
Okay. And, hard to pronounce, but is there a nickname you use for it? LUT?
I don't believe, I've never actually heard anyone say it out loud, I guess.
Okay.
we just internally call it LWT.
Okay. So what's the other one?
The other one is async. Okay. And that's from Jane Street. And so LWT has the benefit that it has no C dependencies, and it can run in, for example, a unikernel environment.
Okay.
And then async is, and it's kind of made by academics more or less for, you know, research purposes. And then async is driven by very particular industrial needs of Jane Street. They need it to be very, very fast for what they do. And so they don't care if they have C dependencies. And so you have these big trade-offs depending on which one you're using. And LWT is getting better every day. It's really impressive, actually. But we originally used LWT for our concurrency. And we used, there's a library called CoHTP, C-O-H-T-P. And that has both a HTTP client and an HTTP server module. And that's what we use, you know, as just kind of the, we want to be purist as much as possible and, you know, no C, and maybe we want to ship on Unikernel someday. And we were getting to the point where we had built out, you know, enough of a prototype of the service where we put it under load testing, and it just crumbled really, really badly.
That was
pretty bad. It was, and it was, you know, tens of thousands of lines of code at that point.
Oh, that must have been disheartening.
Yeah, exactly. Luckily, there was a project called HTTP-AF, which is a alternative HTTP server. And that was just coming out around that time. And we had no option. It was, you know, go with this super, super bleeding edge thing or use this thing that we know doesn't work. And so we tried it out, and it only supported Jane Street's async at the time, and that's actually why we switched over to async.
Okay.
But as a result of that, actually everything ran beautifully. It was very, very smooth. And so, And that also opened us up to using all of Jane Street's core library and whatnot. And so we've kind of gone more and more down that road. And it'll be interesting to see if we ever kind of come back.
Okay. So I'm interested to hear the numbers. I mean, once you started load testing down that route, are you finding that you feel like you have a comparable situation to, or a better situation than you would have on Node, for example? I mean, because Node is interpreted, right? So I'm hoping you'll have at least better performance. Like, what was your, how many requests per second? And like, what kind of stuff did you find yourself doing?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but we also, in the beginning, we experimented with writing it in Clojure, because Clojure has a great GraphQL server library.
Okay.
And also Elixir, OneGraph actually works really well for the Beam VM, you know, the Erlang VM. And so we were really interested in that, but we really wanted the type safety. And so the hope was that, you know, Reason would be within, you know, would be close enough to these other systems that we wouldn't have to give up the type safety to get reasonable performance. And like now we have a system where, yeah, we don't really have any problem with performance at all. We're able to run everything on a single machine if we need to, and we can scale out the machines horizontally as much as we need to.
Awesome.
So the architecture works really, really well for us now.
Wow. So tell me about, this is a pretty significant choice to go server side and use, you're definitely in a place where Jane Street is big and powerful, but I don't know that their business is mainly making like user-facing HTTP servers. I think they're mostly doing a lot of internal stuff. I might be wrong about that. But do you feel like your back is a little bit exposed to the dangers of the world by being in such an unused place, or do you feel pretty confident in it?
Well, so this was, like I said, kind of going back to the beginning. And when I first did, you know, Y Combinator in 2011, and that was my first, you know, venture-backed startup, and I was pretty fearful. You know, I was nervous, and I think that led to a lot of activity without a lot of progress. And so this time around, like the theme of everything has to be sustainable, right? We have to, like, everything has to be sustainable. To give an idea, like, there's a part of San Francisco where all of the startups are, and I don't really get a lot of energy whenever I'm in there. I very much prefer kind of nature and whatnot. And so I would much more prefer to be, you know, near a park, even if that makes us more difficult to get, you know, certain meetings or whatever. I think that's much more sustainable over the long term. And I don't want to have that short term game versus long.
Makes sense.
Similarly with the tech choices, the idea was, all right, I'm not going to rush into this. I'm going to build out the infrastructure. So, you know, I spent a year building out very, very low level infrastructure, figuring out how to do continuous deployment and scale things out and whatnot. So that when we did go full time, we would be able to move quickly, refactor quickly, and be happy, right? If you go into work every day and you're feeling depressed about what you have to do, and you know that you're going to break things and you're going to spend a lot of time just being unhappy, that's not sustainable. And so I think that we've actually built up a situation where we're in a really, really sustainable situation, right? To give an example, there was one demo I was doing, and I was hacking furiously for about 24 hours, just, you know, nonstop. And I was ripping out code, and I was going to come back and refactor it, but I was doing a pretty sloppy job, and I was desperately relying on, you know, the system we had built and the type system to be able to catch me whenever I was making mistakes. And I never would have been able to move that fast at that scale. It was something like, you know, 20,000 lines of code were changed. I would never have been able to have moved that fast without the guarantees that the type system gave me. So, you know, we're exposed, but the way that we got around that was by taking a slow and methodical approach so that we could move fast in the long term.
So tell me about, okay, that makes sense. And here's another aspect of the exposure that I would worry about. Like, what about security? Like, who's battle testing HTTP AF to make sure that it's not, you know, just like open holes everywhere for attackers to get in and find exposed memory or just take you down easily? Things like that. I mean, is that a concern, or do you feel like Jane Street has covered those kind of things?
So most of the time, the memory unsafe stuff is going to be introduced by, you know, probably the lower level C dependencies.
Okay.
And that doesn't really exist in most of the stuff that we use. We have very few C dependencies in our code base. And there can be logical issues as well. And I think for a while, you know, there are two implementations of SSL or TLS in OCaml. Okay. One is a set of bindings to OpenSSL, and the other is a peer rewrite of cryptography, all queries that OpenSSL does in OCaml.
Whoa.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Was that just like one person in their spare time? Because that could be worrisome, unless it passed like a standardized test suite or something.
Yeah, so it's actually by the Unikernel folks that we mentioned earlier.
Sounds trustworthy.
And, okay. You know, yeah, exactly. The Cambridge people, and in particular, like some really smart people have been working very hard on, and people who care deeply about this stuff. And I'm pretty sure. So they also worked on certified C compilers. If you're familiar with that work. The idea of can we formally verify build a C compiler which is formally verified to not have any of these security vulnerabilities or bugs.
Astounding.
So they really care about correctness and whatnot. And so they've been building this thing out. And I think that if we were to do this 10 years ago, close to impossible. And things are getting to the edge where, you know, it's bleeding edge. You will bleed if you do this, but it is possible. And the idea is if we can ride that wave and encourage it and build up the ecosystem enough, then we'll really benefit on the other side.
So here's then a question about the blood. Like, how much have you bled doing this, and in what areas? Have you, as far as the server itself goes, have you had to spend a ton of time writing your own, like, body parsing libraries and, you know, rate limiting and all kinds of, like, are you having to rewrite a ton of stuff that otherwise you could have just picked up from a package repository somewhere?
Actually, that's a good example. We actually literally had to write the multi-part HTTP body parsing code for CoHTTP whenever we were doing file uploads, and that took a while to, you know. But the idea, again, so this was part of that year-long building that low-level stuff, and, you know, I forgot the first RFC I implemented. Maybe it was an HTTP server or, you know, a CAS server or something like that years ago. And it initially sounds intimidating, but then you go and you read the RFC, the spec, and it says, do this thing and you may not do that. And that's optional. And you write it once and then you're done. And so I was willing to take the pain to do that. On the other hand, some of the bugs that we find are much more challenging. In particular, CoHTP is what we use for the vast majority of our HTTP calls. Right, OneGraph mainly talks to other APIs. That's very, and there was a bug in it where it couldn't handle the TLS certs that Cloudflare was using. And so you can imagine that there's a lot of sites that are fronted by Cloudflare, and we would hit it and it would actually cause a bug for us. So what we ended up doing was we pulled in OCurl, which is a OCaml library wrapping, libcurl, which powers the curl command line tool. But it didn't have an async. It only worked for LWT. So we had to build that out. That eventually caused some sort of race condition that would cause the whole server to crash because of file descriptor issues between HTTPAF, OCurl, and async. And so that was a whole nightmare. The correct solution was to ping some of the people who actually worked on CoHTP, and they were able to fix it within, I don't know, a couple of days. And so we went back to that, and everything has been hunky-dory. But we do kind of walk on eggshells around there and try to limit our exposure so that we don't hit those too much. So we try to go back or out just enough to validate, are we going to hit this problem? And if so, in maybe a month or two, what's our plan of action? How do we get around this so that this isn't going to become a threatening issue?
Wow, that's amazing. So did you run into most of those bleeding problems with CoHTP, and then HTTPAF hasn't presented those issues to you, or are there just different challenges?
HTTPAF has been great. We were the first users of it, I believe, outside of the author. And so we have definitely found bugs in the implementation, but both Spiros and Antonio. So Antonio has been just doing great work on OCaml GraphQL server, along with Andreas. He's also been working on some unikernel stuff and HTTPAF. And they've been great about kind of going in and fixing it up very, very quickly.
So HTTPAF is not from Jane Street?
No, it is now, I think, it's used inside of Jane Street, but it was originally created outside of it.
Okay, so Jane Street picked it up after you started using it, I assume, or?
I think they probably did it after us, but I don't know exactly. They don't talk a ton about that kind of thing.
Okay, so let me then ask you about your advice for somebody who's wanting to use Reason. I mean, there are lots of reasons to want to use Reason on the server, and that's why I'm doing it as well. I ended up making the choice to go JS and Node, and that has its own pains for sure. But if somebody were coming up to you and saying, hey, I want to do a startup, I want to not have to do, essentially, like, I've got this business idea, I want to do a startup, I want to scale quickly and not have to scale in the sense of both number of users on my platform and amount or the volume or quantity of code that we're writing, and I want it to be pretty solid. So I'm thinking I want to use Reason, but tell me about the story. Should I go to Node on the back end, or should I go to native? Kind of what would your reasoning be to them? I assume you'd ask them about their situation and find out what was important to them, but kind of what, walk me through that for a second.
Yeah, sure. I think generally speaking, you want to be careful about what your goal is. So if you have, if your goal is to do the standard, get to market as quickly as possible, scale out as quickly as possible, and that is my only overriding goal, right? Like, my whole life is going to be dedicated to this thing 24/7. I have nothing outside of this. Then I think that it's okay to give a lower priority to the things that are, to anything else. And so in that case, I think if you were to use Reason, so if you were to use Clojure, for example, or Node, I think both of them have fantastic ecosystems. So Clojure is on the JVM. You have access to just amazing resources, right? There are so many libraries, great tooling for performance, all this kind of thing. That's similar with Node, right? Node has had just a crazy amount of investment. And you probably know the problems you're going to run into, right? It's like, that you're going to have these type errors. You're going to have undefined is not a function or null pointer exceptions. And, if that is not your main priority, then, go for it. On the other hand, I think if you want to build for the long term. If you want to be able to hire the kind of people I would like to be able to work with, I think it's okay to step back and say, these are low level issues that we are going to have to tackle. We have to plan accordingly. It's going to take longer in the short term, but over the medium to long term, we're going to it's going to pay off. So the question is kind of like, if you just got into YC today and you're starting at the very beginning, you probably don't want to use Reason on probably, I would suspect even Reason on Node, because yeah, you are going to be slowed down quite a bit by all this stuff.
We have,
but
sure,
if you've planned and like this is part going, you've accounted for that amount of time, then whenever you hit YC, like we did, you'll be ready to actually scale faster than if you were to just, you know, throw something together in Node, I think.
Wow. So then once, tell us how that story went. I mean, you were prepared, you went to YC. Did it prove out the way you'd hoped it would? Have you been able to scale as quickly as you'd hoped and prepared for?
Yeah. Actually, I have a local talk I'd like to give here where we brought on some, we have a junior developer who just graduated from university and came and has been hacking, building apps on top of OneGraph, including the Spotify app that we'll release soon. And they built some apps in both Node and JavaScript. They built others using Reason on the front end and native Reason with OCaml GraphQL server and all that kind of stuff. And their ability to move once they were resigned to their fate that they had to write in this Reason language, they weren't totally sure why they had to, but once they accepted it, they were able to move so much more quickly and with a lot less fear. And so we've seen like the ability for both us to make drastic changes across our code base is huge now. Unfortunately, like one of OCaml's issues, I think, is whenever you're first coming in, you're not really sure how to express a lot of things. And this leads to a lot of duplication of code. And so at one point, I think we had close to 1 million lines of generated code. We were generating a lot of code.
Wow.
And as we have learned how to bring in both better performance with while maintaining better expressivity, it's kind of reduced quite a bit. And I think that knowledge then makes it easier for the junior developers to come on board as well. So you can kind of teach them that they know how to do this thing in Node. Why is it so difficult in Reason? And you can kind of express the challenges they would actually have on the Node side and say, here are the ways to express this in a way that don't have those problems. So very similar to the making impossible states, you know, impossible talk by Richard Feldman on the Elm language.
Great talk.
Yeah, exactly. And so kind of being able to figure out what are those patterns, how do you implement it so that you can actually scale out well. And I think for us now, like it would be close to impossible to do this without a language that was checked at compile time with a very strong type system.
So that's definitely an affordance that you chose or rather that's the main benefit that you chose. And that's where I've been going with this language too. And a huge part of the reason that I chose it is because our team knows how to work in a functional paradigm. So functional was important to us, and B, a type system that's flexible yet pretty comprehensive was important to us as well. And that's worth it to us to pay the innovation price that we've had to do to run on top of Node. So that's really interesting. Great answer.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think the innovation price is an interesting term.
It's cost money. I mean, that's a real thing. Cost money and time and frustration, but it has been fun too. I mean, we've gotten to do some innovation in wondering, well, what's the new best practices, you know, since this is kind of a new thing that we haven't heard anyone else do, but now I've done it. I've done a bunch of figuring out, and if I'm able to share that knowledge or share those tools with others who are coming in the future, it's going to be way easier for them to get on board.
Exactly.
So, is that what you're doing too? Have you shared some of the stuff that you've done openly?
Yeah. So we have not done a bunch of open source. We have some stuff coming out fairly soon, but not really on the Reason side. What I've done is I run the local Reason Dojo along with Ben Sanssouci in San Francisco. I do a bunch of Reason workshops everywhere, and I try to get people on board. And we actually did the Reason Euro Dojo last year, which was just amazing. So a dojo format, you know, instead of a workshop, is very specific. It's set up where you have teams of maybe three or four people. Only one person is coding at any given time. Each team is trying to do the same project in about 2 or 3 hours. So oftentimes we'll make like Fruit Ninja or something like that.
Okay.
And the rule is the person who's typing is the person who has the least experience with Reason. And the last thing is, in the very beginning, we split up everyone. So anyone who has experience with Reason, we separate them out. We number everyone off into teams. And then we assign someone who has experience to every team. So what you get is this nice interaction where the person who has the least experience feels a little bit under pressure initially because they're the center of attention and they're typing. But because they're just typing, everyone else is trying to think about how to solve the problem. So that takes the pressure off like how to reason about this language, and they actually get practice for typing out Reason.
That's
and so
great.
It actually is a lot more calming for them. And then on the other side, for the other people who don't have experience, so often the problem when you're learning a new language or a new library is you know how to do a thing in another language, but you can't figure out how to express it in this one. And it's so frustrating. And it can take you like 2 days to figure it out. That would just be like 5 minutes if you were sitting next to someone who knew how to do it. So now with having someone experienced on each one of these teams, they can actually immediately unblock you and explain how to do it. So people who have no experience end up writing like Fruit Ninja in a like WebGL, OpenGL library in like 2.5 hours. It's amazing.
I love that.
And
that's
so
awesome.
We did this at the last ReasonConf, and 150 people who did three different dojos. And we realized that like we have 150 people from all over Europe. Let's go ahead and like they're all qualified now to run their own dojo. So we actually set up a simultaneous dojo about 2 weeks after last year's ReasonConf that took place in 26 different cities across Europe, also South Africa and Tokyo, where everyone was simultaneously working on the same project. And the project was really set up by Ben. And it was amazing. The idea was you're building a map in the browser, and you need to ping our servers using the Fetch library. And our server will do a geo IP lookup of the people who are pinging us. We add that to a list, and we return the list to you. And the list is all the people who have pinged us, all their like latitude and longitude. And so we had a finished version of it that we were looking at. And what would happen is as these teams got made progress and they started pinging our servers, a city would light up on the map. And so 26 cities simultaneously built out with no Reason experience beforehand, this mapping system for everyone simultaneously. It was just really, really cool. So that's kind of how I've been trying to help onboard new users to the Reason ecosystem.
That is way cool. That's amazingly cool. And so great inspiration for you, listener, if you want to figure out how to help grow Reason in your community. Start a dojo. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's become, I think, fairly popular. I mean, Vienna has kind of really led the way, I think, in mentoring people around Europe for doing it.
So we're going to run out of time. So let's jump to this example project. You talked about a Spotify app that you wrote, and I'm assuming you're going to open source it so that people can see how OneGraph is used that way.
Yep. Yeah. So the idea is it's kind of Spot DJ. It's a way to like synchronize what you're listening to on Spotify. So it's entirely written in Reason. It's all front end. There is no server side. It just uses OneGraph to control your Spotify. And the idea is whenever you first load it up, it'll ask you to log into Spotify. And if you're the DJ, it will just kind of pull and, you know, look at what you're listening to. And it will give you a URL that you can share with anyone else. And those other people can then and log into Spotify, and it will synchronize their Spotify with your Spotify. So if you change the song or you scroll in the position, you scrub across the song, it'll update all of them. And it does this without any server, just using WebRTC to communicate these changes along with GraphQL. GraphQL is like a beautiful match for Reason. because usually dealing with external APIs and Reason is incredibly painful because there's just no like type definition at all. And so like translating into and out of these external data sources is just really difficult. And GraphQL, it just native, it just feels great. And so like with very little code, we built this Reason app. The styling is in BS in Motion. So it's also like CSS and JS in Reason, and WebRTC in Reason, and GraphQL in Reason. So yeah, it's really nice. So hopefully we'll have that open sourced to go along with this podcast episode.
That's pretty amazing. An app that synchronizes multiple Spotify listeners that's serverless per se, like you can deploy it on Netlify because it's just entirely built on top of OneGraph. That's great. So tell us in like 1 minute pricing model for OneGraph, how much is it going to run us?
Yeah, sure. So most of our paying customers are fairly like early startups, and we have a few kind of bigger, more established companies that are starting to use us. The idea is we make most of our money from kind of enterprise offerings. So this will be things like, do we integrate with the HashiCorp Vault for encryption with credentials and whatnot? Everyone else, we'll meter the number of requests per month and a few other features. But it's mostly like, unless you're using this in a very serious way, it probably won't cost you much of anything. It's very similar to kind of the Firebase pricing.
Okay, interesting. So it'll just like go online. In other words, if you're a listener, just go online and see what the price would be.
Yeah, exactly. So for most people, like unless you are building out a pretty serious enterprise tool that, you know, links Jira and Salesforce and a lot of these other things together at a large scale, the cost will probably be free for you.
Oh, awesome.
The exception will be probably around open source apps. So we give some of those enterprise. So some of the open source apps have to work with these more enterprise APIs, and we have like an open source package that works for them. But for most projects or startups, it should be free. And then if it gets to some high scale, it'll be about $250 a month for maybe, you know, something like several hundred thousand requests per month.
That makes sense. So, but if you are a startup that is at that scale, hopefully you figured out your business model and you're making the money to be able to pay that.
Well, exactly. And what we have in we do a bunch of interesting things. So in particular, one of the things we're able to do eventually is going to be around rate limiting. And it's really handling rate limiting without changing your code. And it's really nice, you know, whenever you have implemented this thing, you're starting to scale out, to not have to go back and rewrite your code to handle the fact that like you're breaking Salesforce's API limits.
Yeah.
And just kind of flip the switch and say, look, we'd rather just pay money because we're making money from these users. And so that's where the features that we actually charge for right now.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting. Well, we're going to keep a very interested eye on you and how you grow. And I was going to leave time for you to kind of make suggestions about Reason and tell us what your favorite parts were and make some picks and stuff, but we are out of time. So why don't you give us one favorite Reason pick right now?
Oh, Reason pick. I think the work that Antonio has been doing on unikernels with HTVAF is super cool. And also OCaml GraphQL server is by far the best way to write any GraphQL server. The problems that people talk about having with like building it in Node are so foreign to me. I don't understand. I often feel like, isn't that just handled already? Like, don't you have a type-safe system? And like, so building a GraphQL server in Reason will be, yes, I really recommend it.
Awesome. Okay, we'll put those links in the show notes, and I will skip my picks today. And so we'll just say thanks to everyone for listening in, and big thanks to you, Sean, for taking the time to come on and tell us about this. Where can people find you to follow up with questions?
Yeah, you can either come to OneGraph or I'm on Twitter, just sgrove.
Okay, sgrove, and I'm on Twitter at SplodingSocks if you're interested in asking me any questions. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also love to get some ratings in iTunes or whatever podcast client you used, Overcast, etc. And that's it. That's it for today. So we'll sign off and say sayonara, everybody.
All right, thank you so much. Cheers.